This is Spectator Radio, the Spectator's curated podcast collection.
This is a Saturday edition of Spectator Coffeehouse Shots. I'm James Kirkup, a sometime Spectator writer, also sometimes run a think tank. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Rory Stewart. So, Rory, I suppose I'll say a little bit about how this conversation came about. It happens because you've been talking about your politics and your ambitions, and you said at some point recently, when someone asked you to describe your politics, you said you were a politician of the radical centre. And I sent you a WhatsApp message about this, because I run a think tank that describes itself as the think tank of the radical centre. So should we start with that? What do you mean by the radical centre? Where is the centre of politics?
So the centre of politics is about unity. It's about reaching across, but it's radical because it's not a fudge or a grey area in the middle. It's not a weak place. It's a very strong place to be because you are taking the energy from the right and the left, and you're focusing on the issues which are at the heart of the centre. And for me, they're about creating a Britain which is, if I sound a bit soundbitey for a moment, which is fair, which is green, and which is unified.
And that's all good. That's nice. That sounds like reaching out across party lines about trying to find points of consensus with people outside the Conservative Party. But the reason we're having this conversation is because you're running to be leader of the Conservative Party. So isn't there a bit of a contradiction in that? I mean, to get this job, you need the support of Conservatives, but you're talking an awful lot about the need to reach out to non-Conservatives.
In order to have a Conservative government, in order to beat Jeremy Corbyn, get Brexit done, in order to unify the country, which are the three things that people want, we have to be able to listen to people. We have to be able to win an election. And winning an election means listening to everybody, talking to everybody. I'm at the moment doing walks around Britain. And what I'm doing through those walks is walking around divided communities that can often feel divided between North and South, or between Scotland and England, or between young and old, or between different ethnic groups. And in every case, what I'm finding is that if you move into the particular issues that really matter, GP waiting times, safety on the streets, the fact that you can't afford to rent a house if you live in Lewisham or Barking, you begin to find that there is far more in common than divides us. And as a Conservative, I feel very strongly that this is about getting the right energy in the economy, having sound money, not borrowing for things that don't have any value, not cutting taxes when you can't cut taxes, delivering a practical, moderate Brexit on the one hand, and on the other hand, getting all the environment right for business, dealing with the problems at the moment, High Street, which is that if you're running a business in the high street, you're paying huge amounts of business rates, you can't compete with Amazon. Right the way through to understanding that there are things that government could be getting on with. Government could be gripping and delivering. And housing is probably the biggest example of that. We would get much more housing in the ground if the government built the housing.
So that is a state programme of state house building. The central government just goes out and says, we're buying land, we're buying bricks, we're employing bricklayers, we will build them.
And that's the way you get 2 million houses in the ground over the next 5 years. And that's the way you unleash opportunity.
But I certainly think that there's good arguments for that. I know it's been looked at in bits of government before. But the question, I suppose, of philosophy and politics, is that a Conservative solution to a problem with the housing market? I mean, isn't there a critique of your argument that could be made, has been made by people in the Conservative Party, that these are all slightly bloodless technocratic solutions that could be adopted by anybody of any party? What's Tory about this?
What's Tory about it is it's about action. The bloodless technocrats are the people who spend their time talking the theory and don't get on and do anything. All these people who are claiming to be energetic have failed to build those houses. They're not getting more than 200,000 houses a year into the ground. Being radical and bold is saying, we have a problem, we don't have enough houses. And being radical and bold is solving that problem. Again, being radical and bold in prisons is not pontificating about what is the purpose of a prison. It's saying the windows are broken, the trash is on the ground, the prisons aren't being searched, I'm getting the x-rays in, I'm searching the prisons, I'm cutting down on the drugs, I'm cutting down on the violence, I'm getting it done. What people want in this country is less talk and more action. And being a Conservative is about getting on with things. And the problem with this campaign is everybody's talking grand theory. What actually we need to do is get our feet on the ground. If you get out and talk to people out there, they want you to fix things. Let me take another example. One of the biggest problems in this country is the elderly. Nobody in this campaign has a proper...
You mean the elderly are a problem. You mean the problem is the care of the elderly, the situation the elderly find themselves in.
Exactly. One of the biggest problems in this country is the elderly and how we care for them. And we are all getting older, more and more. In my constituency, we will have double the number of people with Alzheimer's next 15 years. Nobody in this campaign is really thinking about probably the biggest issue in British public life, which is how do we provide decency, pride, comfort, company for an increasingly elderly population. And that is the fundamental test for civilised society.
Well, on that, I mean, broadly speaking, I agree. But didn't your party tried, or your now outgoing leader tried? I mean, the 2017 general election, your manifesto, if you ask most people what they remember of it, they will say, oh, wasn't that long with the dementia tax in it? Now, I'm happy to say this. I think the dementia tax was, broadly speaking, quite a good idea, because what it did was it tried to shift the burden of costs. It tried to raise the money to fund social care for the elderly from housing assets. And the value of those assets has been driven up by a number of forces over a number of years. A lot of people are sitting on very valuable property. It seems to me sensible and fair that we should try and extract some of the value of those assets and use that to provide the necessary vital public service of social care for the elderly, because the alternative way of funding that care is from general taxation. And if you do that, you're going to be asking younger people on lower wages to pay more tax to provide for the care of older people who have valuable assets. So that's my version of the story of the dementia tax. But your party and possibly the electorate said, no, don't like that. Terrible idea. Mustn't go ahead. It got binned after, 48 hours? I mean, is there a... What's the way of you?
James, with respect, you're not going to make it as a politician. I mean, that was a very, very complicated technocratic answer.
Do you think I should run a think tank instead of maybe...
And I think what we need in this country is to get out of the language of think tanks, right? We have a problem. We have a problem in this country. We are not looking after the elderly properly.
A lot of people will vote for that.
We're not looking after the elderly properly. We need to fund it. We need to sort it out. What was the problem in that election? The problem was that we made it into a party political issue and we dropped it into a manifesto with no warning. Was bad politics, bad negotiation. Start with a problem, solve it, and understand that actually the way to solve it is to get a national conversation going quickly. Get, for my money, citizens' assembly in a room, get a jury, 99 citizens, sit down with experts, go through the details, make the recommendations to Parliament, take it out of party politics, and produce a situation where we do not have a world. When a carer goes to visit an older person, they are limited to 15 minutes. 15 minutes to bathe them, 15 minutes to feed them. They need to be able to have human contact. There are so many things in this country which need to be sorted out. Let me give you another example. Hearing aids. My father was 92. In the last few years of his life, partly because he'd injured his hearing during the war, he was very, very deaf. Incredibly isolating, lonely experience. We talk all the time about technology, and everybody thinks it's something about young people. Technology for hearing aids is absolutely terrible. Completely unable still to properly distinguish a voice in a crowded room or around a dinner table. I would put £500 million immediately into research and development in our universities for hearing aids. It doesn't sound very trendy, but guess what? Revolutionizes science and technology in our universities. Gets a business product off the ground of which there will literally be billions of customers for British businesses. And it solves one of the fundamental problems of aging. Why is nobody talking about hearing aids in this debate?
That's a very good question. But isn't this, I mean, we've just gone through house building, social care, hearing aids. And the answer is one word, Brexit. I mean, that's all anybody wants to talk about, isn't it? And certainly we know from such polling as there is on the Conservative members who are going to decide who is the next party leader and prime minister, the thing they're most interested in, is that a fair contention? They're most interested in Brexit, aren't they? I mean,
people are not interested in Brexit. They're interested in getting Brexit done. They're interested in the fact they voted to leave the European Union and we haven't left, and they want it done. And if you look at the details of why people voted for Nigel Farage, It's not actually about the details of the deal, exactly what they think about tariffs or quotas. They're just frustrated that we were due to leave in March.
You mean
we haven't left.
17.4 million people didn't vote the way they did because they were concerned about the way the Acquis Communautaire infringed on their sovereign rights under Magna Carta, that there might have been something else going on in that vote. This is strong stuff.
Today, what is really driving this issue is people want to get it done. And the single biggest test for any of the candidates in this race is who can get it done most quickly. Most quickly. That is the question. All comes down to speed, getting it done.
So does that not mean that, you know, it's an argument against delay, isn't it? That's
absolutely.
Yeah, we've got a deadline, 31st of October. You're in favour of leaving on the 31st of October.
I am in favour of getting it done. Talking about leaving on the 31st of October through a no deal is a fantasy. It is a recipe for delay. No deal sounds like a decisive, quick way of cracking the problem. It is exactly the reverse. Parliament is not going to vote for no deal. The European Union is not going to give a different deal. So all those other candidates out there, and it is literally every candidate, as far as I'm concerned, except me in this race, who are saying they're going to try to negotiate with the European Union. If they don't get what they want, they're going to go for no deal. All of them are saying this. None of them prepared to take no deal off the table, are fantasizing. And what they're going to end up with is endless delay. Their strategy is going to end up with us still in the European Union in the middle of next year.
Just to spell it out, what is your route to getting it done as quickly as possible? What would go through the sequence of events that follow the arrival of Rory Stewart, Prime Minister, in office?
You have to understand what the problem is. And the problem is that we are not getting this through Parliament. Hmm. And you have to solve the problem Parliament.
So you need a majority in, well, primarily the Commons, for the withdrawal agreement?
Correct.
And that's something that Theresa May's tried four times to no avail.
The fact that she's tried
and
failed
doesn't
mean that that isn't still the problem. We live in a parliamentary democracy. The only way of getting this through is through Parliament. What you are looking for is somebody who can unlock Parliament and get it through Parliament. And what do you need for that? I believe you need a citizens' assembly to deliver that.
That'll take a while, won't it? I mean, you talk about speed. I mean, if you're going to go out, select however many hundred people, listen to them, consult among them, wait for the wait for Rousseau's general will to emerge from the populace.
It's not
going to happen soon, is it?
We're talking about 3 or 4 weeks, maybe 5 weeks. And the way that this works is that you take it out of Parliament, you bring it back to essentially something that would feel like a jury. So, say, 99 normal people, and they would then sit down and they would look at these issues in detail and they would make recommendations. And this is what they did in Ireland on abortion, which was just like Brexit, very divided. Everyone was anti-abortion or pro-abortion. What they found when you put normal people in a room focusing on an issue for 3 weeks with experts, with proper support, is that they break the issue down into its details. You break Brexit down into those details. You break it down into what kind of opportunities do you want for British business in the future? Do you want to sell 10 million, tens of millions of electric cars into Europe? What sort of trading relationship would you need to do that? And you come out of that with recommendations to Parliament. And that's what unlocks Parliament, because Parliament is then moved from being what it is at the moment, which is party political naysayers, into a general national conversation about how to get this done.
I know you don't want to talk about philosophy and theory, but can we talk about Edmund Burke? Important man in the intellectual tradition of your party, outlined a theory that said the duty and job of elected politicians is to exercise judgment on behalf of the electorate. You're not sent to Parliament as a delegate of the people of the border, as you represent. You're there to exercise your judgment on their behalf. And what you're talking about is effectively Parliament subcontracting decision-making to somebody else, aren't you?
Parliament would remain sovereign. This body could only make recommendations. But the difference between what Burke is talking about and the situation we have now is that Burke was speaking in the 18th century before the development of 24-hour media, before the development of our modern party system. And his vision was very similar to the type of citizens' assembly I'm talking about. He was imagining members of Parliament sitting down for 3 weeks to intensely listen and consider an issue, get into the details, master the differences between a customs union and a single market, and then on the basis of their conscience and understanding, make recommendations going forward. And the question is, which Burke would have understood, is the question of interests. what interest does Jeremy Corbyn have in listening quietly and fairly to what the best solution to this is? Or let's put it against Conservative MP. You could pose the same question against them. It's different with 99 citizens in a room. They would have the opportunity to listen to this evidence and make the recommendations. Now, I may be wrong, James. Maybe that at the end of this period of 5 weeks, we end up in a world in which we just have half of them saying they want a no-deal Brexit and half of them saying they want a second referendum. No. If that were true, I've wasted 5 weeks. But it's far, far more likely that we'll crack it this way because than any of the other fantasies that people have.
You said earlier on that you're walking around a lot, you're encountering a divided country, and this is a conversation, a bit of name-dropping here. I was doing an event the other day with John Curtis, the Sophologist Royal, and John's argument, or John's point on the current state of Brexit, John is effectively a defender of Parliament, because when some people say, oh, Parliament's broken, the process isn't working, politicians aren't doing their job, John says, yes, yeah, Parliament is working perfectly well at the moment. It is representing and reflecting the views of the electorate, because the electorate is fundamentally divided on this issue. Isn't there a risk that, exactly what you've described comes about, that you put 99 representative people in a room and it turns out that there's a bunch in the middle who basically would like to get on with this, but there are 25 on one side who absolutely desperately want to leave the European Union come what may, and 25 on the other side who say they never want to leave at all.
James, we can find out whether you're right or I'm right, right? It'll take 5 weeks. Yeah. And what are you going to lose? It's the quickest way, I believe, of getting Brexit done. And it may turn out that you put 99 people in a room, you make them listen to the greatest experts in the world, they educate themselves about all the details of British industry, the customs union, the single market, and all the trade-offs, and they end up at the end of 3 weeks thinking exactly what they did before they went into the room. My experience is that isn't true. My experience actually in associations up and down this country is if I can begin to get people to think about the future, about what our farmers need, about what our car manufacturers need, about what kind of trade deals we can get with Europe and the United States, you can transform this conversation. Think fundamentally, the difference here is that I have more trust in the end in people's ability to get themselves out of this box and find a solution.
Now, you mentioned Jeremy Corbyn, and one of the things I've struck by going here, doing my extensive research on you before this conversation was, I was reminded that once upon a time you were a member of the Labour Party. Early 90s, was it?
So when I was an 18-year-old, I was a member of the Labour Party, yeah.
And when did you join the Conservative Party?
I joined the Conservative Party, well, I was a civil servant, actually. I didn't join the Conservative Party at all. I spent my whole life initially in the army and then as a diplomat and as a civil servant working around the world. So I didn't think it was appropriate to join a political party. So I didn't join the party.
Until?
Well, I didn't join the party until I left government service and decided to then move on to become a member of parliament.
I'm just curious to know about that experience of having been in the Labour Party. And again, coming back to that critique that some people have offered of you, that you are Tim Montgomery's line the other day, that you're the candidate for people who don't vote Conservative. Isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, it's a very good thing. I mean, the key thing is that I'm the candidate who can make people who wouldn't naturally vote Conservative, and that's how we're going to win this election. The problem at the last election is that we didn't get enough seats. Right? If I can get people in Warrington...
You're baffling me with terminology and complicated analysis here. But at that point, on having been a Labour member...
It's a very, very strange analysis you're getting there. Right?
The strength
of me as a candidate is that I have an enormous number of people who would vote Conservative if I was Prime Minister. And that includes a lot of young people. At the last election, only 5% of our voters were under 24.
And this is what I'm curious about. Having been in the Labour Party, having had that experience of being a young person who was a Labour member, what does that teach you? What do you know? What do you understand about people who today look at Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party and think, you know what, that's a good idea, I'll vote for that? What's the insight you have into them? Why do you think they're doing it?
It's what it teaches me is that I could see strongly as an 18-year-old what the attraction of the Labour Party was. And I went through the experience of learning what was wrong with the Labour Party. And as I grew up, in effect, what I realised is that in the end, the problem with the Labour Party is that it's too much about talk and not enough about action. And it's too much about central control and it's not enough about trusting people. And the point at which I really saw most clearly the problem with the way that I feel the Labour Party thinks about the world is when I was serving in Iraq for the British government, listening to the way that Tony Blair was talking about Iraq compared to what the reality was on the ground. I'm a conservative because I'm very suspicious of abstract words generated from government. I'm very interested in actually what's happening on the ground.
I mean, again, there is a... You know, the philosopher would argue, surely, that that's not a philosophical critique of Labour. That's a, you know, that's a pragmatic assessment of effectiveness of a Labour government. I guess I'm curious.
Let me give you another example of why I'm conservative. I march on the Remembrance Day parade with my OBE on my chest, with the veterans from Penrith, through the rain every year, and read the lesson in that church because I am very, very proud of our history, of our traditions, of our armed forces, of the Anglican Church, of everything that that parade represents. I do not imagine that Jeremy Corbyn does that every year.
Bleed right about that. Although equally, there are surely people in the Labour Party who would be equally proud to do all those same things. And
how many of them are as proud of the monarchy as I am? How many of them are as deeply connected to rural life as I am? Uh-huh. How many of them would be fighting for Cumbrian sheep farmers in the way that I am? How many of them feel as I do that there is so much in our history and in our past to celebrate, that our history did not begin in 1945, that we have things from the depths of our past, in our culture, in our communities, in our landscape, which should make us profoundly joyful to be British?
Can I put something to you? A theory. I'm working on this conversation. Actually, secretly, you don't have that much disagreement with people in other parties because they are, by definition, other members of other parties. You're probably having to slightly play up the differences between yourself and other parties because that's not really the way you do politics, is it? I mean, I've spent most of my life around Westminster talking to politicians, and I'm always, you point out earlier on, I would be terrible at politics. There's lots of reasons for that. One of the many reasons is I don't get the tribalism thing. I don't get the taking sides bit. And I suspect you probably have a similar view. You probably naturally look at policies and people and think that's sensible, that's not sensible. And then secondly, you look at whether or not they are conservative or Labour or Liberal Democrat or whatever. I mean,
it's partly a political party. It's partly about a culture. It's a way of acting. It's a way of looking at the world. It's where you feel comfortable, where you feel you have things in common. And in the end, I have far more in common with the people on the Conservative benches than I do the Labour benches. Now, there are issues that we agree on across the House. I think that there are some very, very honourable Labour MPs who deeply care about this country. Tessa Jowell, for example, who was a friend of mine, I was very struck by hearing her say that her fundamental test with a hospital is, would I put my mother in that hospital? And that really struck me, and I thought that was a very powerful way of articulating what she represented. But for a lot of the reasons that I've talked about, I feel much more at home with Conservative Party members, delivering leaflets with Conservative activists, going to a Conservative Party conference than I would with the Labour equivalent. And that has a great deal to do partly with my father. My mother has been a Conservative Party member all her life. My grandmother was a Conservative Party councillor. My father voted Labour once in 1945 after the war as a young soldier, but otherwise was a telegraph reader all his life with views that he would compare to Genghis Khan.
Favourably?
Very favourably. Genghis Khan was one of his great political heroes. I feel...
who are your great political heroes? Who's your favourite dictator and mass murderer from history?
My great hero is a man called Plenty Coup, who was the chief of the Crow Indians. And the reason he's my great hero is that he was the only one of the great Native American leaders who, instead of pretending that the future of their people lay in a suicidal fight against the Anglo-Saxon arrival, decided that what he needed to do was reach out, educate his people, secure a very, very good deal for the Crow Indians, the best reservation land in the United States, and make them now probably the most prosperous integrated community in the United States. And he did it because he was unflinchingly able to face reality. He wasn't like Sitting Bull or the others, fooled into some fantasy of martyrdom to the destruction of his people.
What happened to him in the end?
Plentiku laid the wreath on the tomb of the unknown soldier in 1919, and he died venerated in an old age celebrated by both the Native Americans and by the government of the United States. But his courage was the fact that this was a man who was one of the great braves, one of the great warriors of his time, famous for his ability to fight the Sioux, who realized that that world was ending and achieved a cultural change that worked for his people.
I have to try and tease the analogy out a little further. I'd be failing my job if I didn't. Are you hinting, suggesting there that if the conservative tribe doesn't unflinchingly face reality, as you said, that it may well go the way of the Sioux and some of those other tribes who met a rather stickier fate?
This isn't a comment about conservatives. It's a comment about life and all of us, whichever party we're in, which is true optimism, true growth, true fulfillment, involves an unflinching facing of reality. It's not optimistic to say that you're going to make Britain great if you have no idea how to do it. It's not optimistic to say you're going to make Britain great if you're about to lead someone into the delay of a no-deal Brexit. It's not patriotic to push for a no-deal Brexit that the majority of this country doesn't want. Optimism and patriotism involves loving the country as it is and having a generous and realistic picture of how it can be better, kinder, and happier in 15 years' time than it is today, and knowing how to get there with energy and action.
Last optimistic question. Are you going to win?
Yes.
Hooray! Thank you.